This week's program has again been compiled and recorded earlier in the week, as this weekend I am busy with Jota at Arrow Park in Benoni. There are now three Pico balloons in the air, ZS1ERZ-12 on channel 24 transmitting a 10 meter whisper beacon, which was launched on the 16th of August 2025, was last heard on the 16th of October crossing over the North Island of New Zealand on its sixth trip around the Southern Hemisphere. ZS6SRC-29 on channel 87 with a 20 meter whisper beacon was launched on the 1st of October and is almost three quarters across the Atlantic between Brazil and southern Namibia. ZS6SRC-30, which is also operating a 10 meter whisper beacon on channel 252 and was launched just before the backup balloon on 11th of October, was last heard on the 16th of October just north of Norfolk Island, east of Australia and northwest of New Zealand. These Pico balloons are really attracting a lot of attention. I briefly spoke to Gert, ZS6 Golf Charlie, on Thursday evening when we were online planning a possible deployment to the Barberton area in Mpumalanga to assist in a search of a missing aircraft, and Gert told us that he was busy fulfilling orders for kits for Pico balloons for various clubs who want to launch their own Pico balloons. We are looking forward to reporting on these balloons when they eventually get launched. Well done to everyone who has been involved in this exciting activity, and we hope that the new balloons will also circumnavigate the Southern Hemisphere many times. The current record to chase is at least 5 times. The Baikal 13 launch was really very enjoyable, and the weather was almost perfect at the launch site on Saturday morning. There was a lot of hustle and bustle getting the payloads ready and connected to each other in a train. As I was part of the chase team, we were also getting the last bits and pieces of our equipment organized and operational. We left the airfield as they were preparing to fill the balloon to get into position in Betal, which was more or less central in the predicted flight path for the balloon. There were 5 chase teams who were closely operating the APRS position reports of the balloon. When we saw that the altitude of the balloon started falling, then we rapidly determined an area where the balloon may land and then split up with 2 chase teams following a tar road to the balloon and the other 3 vehicles following a dirt road. We determined that the balloon was falling too fast and that most likely none of the 2 parachutes had opened. The first chase team arrived within about 200 meters of where the balloon had fallen. This chase team consisted of Dedrick ZS6 Delta Victor Lima and Anya ZS6 Sierra Juliet Charlie, followed by Gert, ZS6 Golf Charlie. Both these teams had travelled via the tar road. The rest of the chase teams arrived and the balloon and payloads were recovered, loaded, and then the teams proceeded back to the Highveld Sailing Club at the Trichardsfontein Dam, where the folk were waiting for the recovery teams to deliver the payloads. The payloads were returned to their owners, who immediately opened them to check for damages and to see if they could access data, photos and so forth, to try and figure out what went wrong. Slowly information came to light about what had failed during the flight. For example, the Hamnet LoRa module had failed on takeoff or shortly after takeoff, as we last received the signal as we were leaving the launch site at the airfield. The Hamnet crossband repeater had operated throughout the flight, but had stopped working once the payload hit the ground. We found that the radio would not power on, and most likely the issue was either the battery or the radio had been damaged by the impact. Antennas had also been damaged. The LoRa antenna was completely missing, and the crossband repeater antenna was hanging loose. The biggest mystery was why I had not one of the 2 parachutes deployed. It was later discovered that the GPS on the flight control payload had malfunctioned approximately 6 minutes after flight initialization, which was the cause of the parachutes not deploying. There still remains a lot of analysis of the data that was collected, and then a final report will be compiled. The flight overview was, it was launched at 0554 UTC, it burst at 0720 UTC, the maximum altitude was 29,230 meters, and it crash landed at 0802 UTC. By about 13 hours local time, almost everyone had left to get back home, and the few of us who remained behind had a chance to relax, unwind, and discuss the day's activities. An early night was welcomed, and we departed on Sunday morning, leaving a rainy Secunda to our homes in Gauteng. Being my first balloon recovery, I had a lot of fun, and I learned a lot from my fellow Hamnet colleagues who already had a number of recoveries under their belt. At the time of writing this program, some of my Hamnet team are getting ready to deploy to Barberton in Mpumalanga to provide communications for the search and rescue teams attending to an aircraft incident in the mountains between Barberton and the Eswatini border. One of the things we always talk about is, are you ready to deploy and do you have everything that you need? I've noticed that this is something that very few amateurs think about. Never mind deploying to an incident 4 hours driving time away, but just within your area where you live in. Are you prepared? Listen to this story recorded by Ono, Victor Kilo 6 Foxtrot Lima Alpha Bravo.
Foundations of Amateur Radio. The other day I went on my first POTA or Parks on the Air adventure. This time I was on my own. If you recall, my power company announced yet another planned network outage, and I felt that I could use this time without electricity to my benefit, for a change. As is traditional, I did all the prior planning to prevent pretty poor performance. I made a list, checked that all the items on the list were in my kit, packed the kit days before, put it all ready to go in the hallway the night before, packed the car on the day, and set out on my adventure. I will confess that I was slightly more sweaty than anticipated when I set off, because the umbrella in the boot of my car has a nasty and recurring habit of getting in the way. Specifically, it stops things from getting pushed right to the full depth of the boot. Mind you, it wasn't until I started getting agitated that I realized that it wasn't the umbrella's fault entirely this time, since, as it turns out, the folding chair that I was attempting to jam in place doesn't actually fit long ways into the boot. Anywho, I set off and visited the local petrol station. I was not prepared for a customer to spend 15 minutes dribbling the last bit of diesel into their pretend sports utility vehicle, but he looked like he was up for a fight, so I smiled sweetly and waited for him to pay and move his box on wheels. After paying for my own fuel and driving off, the pressure in my bladder had gotten beyond the cross your legs and hope for the best stages, and I swiftly made my way to the nearest shopping complex, where a local pharmacist helpfully told me that there were no toilets in the building and that the local hotel or fast food joint were the place to relieve the pressure. One problem. They were both closed. At this point, I was in pain and discovered that I couldn't read the screen on my mobile phone in the lovely sunlight because it was set to battery saving mode, since my charger was at home where the power was out. After disabling the battery saving mode, I opened the local public toilet map shortcut on my phone and discovered that fortunately the shortcut still worked, opening up my default browser, which suddenly didn't want to display a map. Copied the URL to another browser, still in pain, finally a map. Click on the nearest icon and it navigates me there from Darwin, or over 4,000 kilometers from where I actually am. Luckily, it has the GPS location, which I copy and then paste into my mapping app, and I can finally navigate to the nearest toilet. Several comment-worthy navigation moves later, I drive into the car park, lock the car, painfully shuffle to the building, do my business in the very clean facilities, and then decide that I should just stop, sit, and take a breath. So I get in the car and discover that my partner was right when they heaped scorn on our newly acquired thermos cup. It really does hurt your nose when you try to drink from it, and the sharp edges in your mouth do nothing to make the experience joyful. Meanwhile, there's some trucks moving around in the car park, and a guy walks up to the car to ask me if I can move because they want to move a third, or was it fourth, truck into the space. I swallow my sip of restorative coffee, wipe the now wet bridge of my nose, and move the car, only to be blocked from leaving the exit thanks to the slowest reversing truck I've ever encountered, one who then proceeds to sit at the next intersection for 5 minutes without indicating where it was going. Are we having fun yet? I finally made my way to the main road, where I attempted to calm my nerves with the help of a Morse code edition of my podcast. It's been the only exposure I've had to Morse for way too long. This accompanies me to my first destination, breakfast. I'm going to skip past the drivers in the centre lane driving at 10 kilometres per hour below the posted speed limit, or the ones who think that jumping out of a side street in front of you is normal and safe driving practice. At every traffic light, I celebrate the pause with a sip from my coffee and a furtive wipe of my nose, which is being assaulted by the lid of the cup. I arrive at my breakfast destination and fear the worst. Their car park is almost empty. I've never seen it this quiet, and I didn't check to confirm that they were open or not. I look at my map application and remember to turn my phone back to battery saving mode. According to the internet, my cafe is open, so I cross my fingers and get out of the car. To my delight, they are absolutely open, make me a lovely breakfast and provide the needful for lunch too. I have a big day planned after all. After enjoying breakfast and hot chocolate with two marshmallows, I get back in the car and navigate to my planned setup location. As I drive into the park, I notice something that I hadn't the last time I was here. I'm descending. As in, the deeper into the park I go, the more I go downhill. That in and of itself isn't a cause for concern were it not for the fact that the local repeaters are on the hilltops that overlook the city, and I'm several hills inland and travelling into a valley. I'm keeping my eyes open for side roads and alternatives, but gamely proceed to the formal entrance of the park, where I pay my $17 to have a car with a maximum of 12 passengers enter the national park. I drive to the location I have planned and discover that there's a car park quite close to the gazebo I've earmarked, so I park there. I figure that before I get all set up in the gazebo for a day of radio, I should first check what I can learn from where I'm parked, especially since I'll need to pull the gear out of the car either way. Before I get out of the car, I attempt to mark my actual location on the map, only to discover that there's no mobile phone coverage, so much for using Echolink as a fallback. I pull out the folding table, which neatly fits next to the car, dig out the coax from the boot and lead it out the passenger door. The other end is connected to the boot lip mount that has been there for years. In case of failure, I did bring a magnetic base. But I'm optimistic. I remove the HF and VHF multiband antennas from their storage spot, taped to the driver's side rear passenger roof grab handle, and pull out the previously errant folding chair. All is going well. I pull out the spare coax and my anxiety spikes a little. This is what I think might be what causes me to come unstuck. It's a 10-meter or so length of coax. It's untested, terminated with BNC, and I'm concerned that I didn't bring enough adapters beyond the BNC to PL259 and the SO239 barrel I packed hastily the night before. I push away my fear since I'm not needing this right now, and I continue to unpack the radio, noticing that to my immense relief, the knobs are still attached. Set it all up, pull the power cable from the 12-volt, 80-amp-hour AGM deep cycle battery, quote, ideal for a four-wheel drive, caravan and camping trailers, end quote, which I bought 4 years ago to power my dash cams and the radio. It's automatically charged by a 360-watt DC-to-DC converter that's connected to the alternator in the car, because I don't want my dash cams, or radio for that matter, to stop me from starting the car. Ask me how I know. The power leads are long enough to make it out of the boot, and I connect the inline voltmeter to the battery, 12.6 volt, the same as what I saw when I checked it a week earlier. I mount the VHF multiband antenna connected to the radio after pulling out the N-type to PL259 adapter, which is on the list and part of the standard kit. I take a breath and turn on my radio, tune to the local repeater frequency and hit the PTT. The radio is set to 5 watts and I'm hoping to hear the repeater tone. Nothing. I check all the repeaters in my radio, about 7 of them. None of them do anything. Then I hear a click. I've been on air for all of 3 minutes. I notice the radio is turned off. I've seen this before. Sometimes stray RF gets into something and causes the radio to stop. I turn it back on and notice the voltage on the display of the radio. 9.65 volts. That is not good. I check the inline voltmeter. It doesn't even display anything. I turn off the radio to save what little power I have. I take a moment to consider and attach the HF antenna, hoping that I can run the radio for a few seconds to check the local 10-meter repeater. All is good to go. Turn on the radio and it won't even turn on, just flickering on and off. I feel like I want to cry, but there doesn't seem to be any point. I pack everything back up. The water, my hat, the radio, the coax, the antennas, the table, the chair, put it all back in where it came from, even the sandwich I was going to have for lunch. After slowly reversing out of the car bay, looking carefully at the ground to make sure I didn't leave anything behind, I make my way out of the park. I've been there for a grand total of 29 minutes. I briefly entertain the idea of going to the nearest electronics store and spending $50 on a small battery. But I don't actually have a working charger, and spending several hundred dollars on a charger and battery is not really in my budget at the moment. Whilst I was driving home, I got a notification that the power was out at my QTH. I got home 52 minutes after the power went out. It stayed off for the next 6 hours. So much for being productive. My friend Charles, November Kilo 8 Oscar, tells me that his first few activations were a bust. He's a Sapphire POTAR activator with 609 activations across 372 parks, so there's hope for me yet. In looking back at this adventure, I was planning for failure. I'd thought through all the different permutations of what might happen. Not for one moment did I consider that my battery might be a single point of failure. That said, there were hints that not all was well. The 12.6 volts was one hint. The fact that my dash cams have been acting up was another. I had been on the hunt for a battery monitor for the past 2 years to discover precisely what was going on, but I haven't found one that doesn't require a specific app that needs to know where you are or what's in your diary, so I put it out of my mind. As it happens, that was where I made my rookie mistake. Mind you, part of me knows that I don't have another battery anyway, so it really didn't matter if the battery was faulty or not. Either way, I wasn't going to connect my radio to my car battery. I learned that lesson well over a decade ago. I'm back to the drawing board. It's unlikely we'll use that location to activate for the 750th edition of F-Troop, but when I get my power situation sorted out, it's still a lovely place to get on air and make some noise. I'm Ono. Victor Kilo 6, Foxtrot Lima, Alpha Bravo.
Are you prepared and can you be self-sufficient? Enough for now. I'm having fun doing Johto with the scouts here at Arrow Park. How about telling us about that exciting long-distance contact that you have made on the VHF and above bands, or about that project that you are working on in the VHF and above bands? Send me a consolidated report on your activity or project with any additional photos, audio or video clips to bjacobza@gmail.com. Remember, by sharing your activities with us at VHF News allows us to tell the rest of the amateur community about your achievements, and the more we promote the activity on the VHF and above bands, the better chance we have of encouraging more amateurs to explore the world above 30 MHz. Focus on VHF and above is compiled, edited, and presented for Amateur Radio Today by Brian Jacobs, ZS6 Yankee Zulu.